Native American allies established their hegemony over New England. After this consolidation of state control, the curves for Old England and New England coincide uncannily. The rest of the Northeast also saw a plunge from triple-digit and high double-digit homicide rates to the single digits typical of the world's countries today. The Dutch colony of New Netherland, with settlements from Connecticut to Delaware, saw a sharp decline in its early decades from 68 to 15 per 100,000. But when the data resume in the 19th century, we start to see the United States diverging from the two mother countries. Though the more rural and ethnically homogeneous parts of New England, Vermont and New Hampshire, continue to hover in the peaceful basement beneath 1 in 100,000, the city of Boston became more violent in the middle of the 19th century, overlapping cities in former New Netherland, such as New York and Philadelphia. The zigzags for the northeastern cities show two twists in the American version of the civilizing process. Apparently, the consolidation of a frontier under government control can bring the annual homicide rate down by an order of magnitude or so, from around 100 per 100,000 to around 10. But unlike what happened in Europe, where the momentum continued all the way down to the neighborhood of 1, in America, the rate usually got stuck in the 5 to 15 range, where we find it today. Roth suggests that once an effective government has pacified the populace from the 100 to the 10 range, additional reductions depend on the degree to which people accept the legitimacy of the government, its laws, and the social order. Eisner, recall, made a similar observation about the civilizing process in Europe. The other twist on the American version of the civilizing process is that in many of Roth's mini data sets, violence increased in the middle decades of the 19th century. The buildup and aftermath of the Civil War disrupted the social balance in many parts of the country, and the northeastern cities saw a wave of immigration from Ireland, which, as we have seen, lagged behind England in its homicide decline. Irish Americans in the 19th century, like African Americans in the 20th, were more pugnacious than their neighbors, in large part because they and the police did not take each other seriously. But in the second half of the 19th century, police forces in American cities expanded, became more professional, and began to serve the criminal justice system rather than administering their own justice on the streets with their nightsticks. In major northern cities well into the 20th century, homicide rates for white Americans declined. But the second half of the 19th century also saw a fateful change. The racial disparity in American homicide has not always been with us. In the northeastern cities, in New England, in the Midwest, and in Virginia, blacks and whites killed at similar rates throughout the first half of the 19th century. Then a gap opened up, and it widened even further in the 20th century, when homicides among African Americans skyrocketed, going from 3 times the white rate in New York in the 1850s to almost 13 times the white rate a century later. A probe into the causes, including economic and residential segregation, could fill another book. But one of them, as we have seen, is that communities of lower-income African Americans were effectively stateless, relying on a culture of honor, sometimes called the code of the streets, to defend their interests rather than calling in the law. The first successful English settlements in America were in New England and Virginia, and a comparison might make you think that in their first century, the two colonies underwent similar civilizing processes. Between 1600 and 1900, the murder rate in the South was roughly 10 times higher than in New England. Unlike the black-white gap, the North-South gap has deep roots in American history. The Chesapeake colonies of Maryland and Virginia started out more violent than New England, and though they descended into the moderate range, between 1 and 10 homicides per 100,000 people per year, and stayed there for most of the 19th century, other parts of the settled South bounced around in the low 10 to 100 range, such as the Georgia plantation counties. Many remote and mountainous regions, such as the Georgia backcountry and Tennessee-Kentucky border, continued to float in the uncivilized 100s, some of them well into the 19th century. Why has the South had such a long history of violence? The most sweeping answer is that the civilizing mission of government never penetrated the American South as deeply as it had the Northeast, to say nothing of Europe. The historian Pieter Spierenburg has provocatively suggested that democracy came too early to America. In Europe, first the state disarmed the people and claimed a monopoly on violence, then the people took over the apparatus of the state. In America, the people took over the state before it had forced them to lay down their arms, which, as the Second Amendment famously affirms, they reserve the right to keep and bear. In other words, Americans, and especially Americans in the South and West, never fully signed on to a social contract that would vest the government with the monopoly on the legitimate use of force. In much of American history, legitimate force was also wielded by posses, vigilantes, lynch mobs, company police, detective agencies, and Pinkertons, and even more often kept as a prerogative of the individual. This power sharing, historians have noted, has always been sacred in the South. As Eric Monkonen puts it, in the 19th century, the South had a deliberately weak state, eschewing things such as penitentiaries in favor of local, personal violence. Homicides were treated lightly if the killing was deemed reasonable, and most killings in the rural South were reasonable, in the sense that the victim had not done everything possible to escape from the killer, that the killing resulted from a personal dispute, or because the killer and victim were the kinds of people who kill each other. The South's reliance on self-help justice has long been part of its mythology. It was instilled early in life, such as in the maternal advice given to the young Andrew Jackson, the dueling president who claimed to rattle with bullets when he walked. Never sue anyone for slander or assault or battery. Always settle those cases yourself. It was flaunted by pugnacious icons of the mountainous South like Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett, the king of the wild frontier. It fueled the war between the prototypical feuding families, the Hatfields and McCoys of the Kentucky-West Virginia backcountry, and it not only swelled the homicide statistics for as long as they have been recorded, but has left its mark on the Southern psyche today. Self-help justice depends on the credibility of one's prowess and resolve. And to this day, the American South is marked by an obsession with credible deterrence, otherwise known as a culture of honor. The essence of a culture of honor is that it does not sanction predatory or instrumental violence, but only retaliation after an insult or other mistreatment. The psychologists Richard Nisbet and Dov Cohen have shown that this mindset continues to pervade Southern laws, politics, and attitudes. Southerners do not outkill Northerners in homicides carried out during robberies, they found, only in those sparked by quarrels. In surveys, Southerners do not endorse the use of violence in the abstract, but only to protect home and family. The laws of the Southern states sanction this morality. They give a person wide latitude to kill in defense of self or property, put fewer restrictions on gun purchases, allow corporal punishment, paddling in schools, and specify the death penalty for murder, which their judicial systems are happy to carry out. Southern men and women are more likely to serve in the military, to study at military academies, and to take hawkish positions on foreign policy. In a series of ingenious experiments, Nisbet and Cohen also showed that honor looms large in the behavior of individual Southerners. In one study, they sent fake letters inquiring about jobs to companies all over the country. Half of them contained the following confession. "There is one thing I must explain because I feel I must be honest and I want no misunderstandings. I have been convicted of a felony, namely manslaughter. You will probably want an explanation for this before you send me an application, so I will provide it. I got into a fight with someone who was having an affair with my fiancée. I lived in a small town, and one night this person confronted me in front of my friends at the bar. He told everyone that he and my fiancée were sleeping together. He laughed at me to my face and asked me to step outside if I was man enough. I was young and didn't want to back down from a challenge in front of everyone. As we went into the alley, he started to attack me. He knocked me down and he picked up a bottle. I could have run away, and the judge said I should have, but my pride wouldn't let me. Instead, I picked up a pipe that was laying in the alley and hit him with it. I didn't mean to kill him, but he died a few hours later at the hospital. I realized that what I did was wrong. The other half contained a similar paragraph in which the applicant confessed to a felony conviction for grand theft auto, which, he said, he had foolishly committed to help support his wife and young children. In response to the letter confessing to the honor killing, companies based in the South and West were more likely than those in the North to send the letter writer a job application, and their replies were warmer in tone. For example, the owner of one Southern store apologized that she had no jobs available at the time and added, "As for your problem of the past, anyone could probably be in the situation you were in. It was just an unfortunate incident that shouldn't be held against you. Your honesty shows that you are sincere. I wish you the best of luck for your future. You have a positive attitude and a willingness to work. Those are the qualities that businesses look for in an employee. Once you get settled, if you are near here, please stop in and see us." No such warmth came from companies based in the North, nor from any company when the letter confessed to auto theft. Indeed, Northern companies were more forgiving of the auto theft than the honor killing. The Southern and Western companies were more forgiving of the honor killing than the auto theft. Nisbet and Cohen also captured the Southern culture of honor in the lab. Their subjects were not bubbas from the bayous, but affluent students at the University of Michigan, who had lived in the South for at least 6 years. Students were recruited for a psychology experiment on limited response time conditions on certain facets of human judgment, a bit of gobbledygook to hide the real purpose of the study. In the hallway on their way to the lab, the students had to pass by an accomplice of the experimenter who was filing papers in a cabinet. In half of the cases, when the student brushed past the accomplice, he slammed the drawer shut and muttered, "Asshole." Then the experimenter, who was kept in the dark as to whether the student had been insulted, welcomed the student into the lab, observed his demeanor, gave him a questionnaire, and drew a blood sample. The students from the northern states, they found, laughed off the insult and behaved no differently from the control group who had entered without incident. But the insulted students from the southern states walked in fuming. They reported lower self-esteem in a questionnaire, and their blood samples showed elevated levels of testosterone and of cortisol, a stress hormone. They behaved more dominantly toward the experimenter and shook his hand more firmly. And when approaching another accomplice in the narrow hallway on their way out, they refused to step aside to let him pass. Is there an exogenous cause that might explain why the South, rather than the North, developed a culture of honor? Certainly the brutality needed to maintain a slave economy might have been a factor, but the most violent parts of the South were backcountry regions that never depended on plantation slavery. Nisbet and Cohen were influenced by David Hacker Fisher's Albion's Seed, a history of the British colonization of the United States, and zeroed in on the origins of the first colonists from different parts of Europe. The northern states were settled by Puritan, Quaker, Dutch, and German farmers, but the interior South was largely settled by Scots-Irish, many of them sheepherders, who hailed from the mountainous periphery of the British Isles beyond the reach of the central government. Herding, Nisbet and Cohen suggest, may have been an exogenous cause of the culture of honor. Not only does a herder's wealth lie in stealable physical assets, but those assets have feet and can be led away in an eye blink far more easily than land can be stolen out from under a farmer. Herders all over the world cultivate a hair trigger for violent retaliation. Nisbet and Cohen suggest that the Scots-Irish brought their culture of honor with them and kept it alive when they took up herding in the South's mountainous frontier. Though contemporary Southerners are no longer shepherds, cultural mores can persist long after the ecological circumstances that gave rise to them are gone, and to this day, Southerners behave as if they have to be tough enough to deter livestock rustlers. The herding hypothesis requires that people cling to an occupational strategy for centuries after it has become dysfunctional. But the more general theory of a culture of honor does not depend on that assumption. People often take up herding in mountainous areas because it's hard to grow crops on mountains, and mountainous areas are often anarchic because they are the hardest regions for a state to conquer, pacify, and administer. The immediate trigger for self-help justice, then, is anarchy, not herding itself. Recall that the ranchers of Shasta County have herded cattle for more than a century, yet when one of them suffers a minor loss of cattle or property, he is expected to lump it, not lash out with violence to defend his honor. Also, a recent study that compared southern counties and their rates of violence and their suitability for herding found no correlation when other variables were controlled. So it's sufficient to assume that settlers from the remote parts of Britain ended up in the remote parts of the South, and that both regions were lawless for a long time, fostering a culture of honor. We still have to explain why their culture of honor is so self-sustaining. After all, a functioning criminal justice system has been in place in southern states for some time now. Perhaps honor has staying power because the first man who dares to abjure it would be heaped with contempt for cowardice and treated as an easy mark. The American West, even more than the American South, was a zone of anarchy until well into the 20th century. The cliché of Hollywood Westerns that the nearest sheriff is 90 miles away was the reality in millions of square miles of territory, and the result was the other cliché of Hollywood Westerns, ever-present violence. Nabokov's Humbert Humbert, drinking in American popular culture during his cross-country escape with Lolita, savors the ox-stunning fisticuffs of the cowboy movies. There was the mahogany landscape, the florid-faced, blue-eyed rough riders, the prim, pretty schoolteacher arriving in Roaring Gulch, the rearing horse, the spectacular stampede, the pistol thrust through the shivered windowpane, the stupendous fistfight, the crashing mountain of dusty old-fashioned furniture, the table used as a weapon, the timely somersault, the pinned hand still groping for the dropped Bowie knife, the grunt, the sweet crash of fist against chin, the kick in the belly, the flying tackle, and immediately, after a plethora of pain that would have hospitalized a Hercules, nothing to show, but the rather becoming bruise on the bronzed cheek of the warmed-up hero, embracing his gorgeous frontier bride. In Violent Land, the historian David Courtwright shows that the Hollywood horse operas were accurate in the levels of violence they depicted, if not in their romanticized image of cowboys. The life of a cowboy alternated between dangerous, back-breaking work and payday binges of drinking, gambling, whoring, and brawling. For the cowboy to become a symbol of the American experience required an act of moral surgery. The cowboy as mounted protector and risk-taker was remembered. The cowboy as dismounted, drunk, sleeping it off on the manure pile behind the saloon, was forgotten. In the American Wild West, annual homicide rates were 50 to several hundred times higher than those of eastern cities and midwestern farming regions, 50 per 100,000 in Abilene, Kansas, 100 in Dodge City, 229 in Fort Griffin, Texas, and 1,500 in Wichita. The causes were right out of Hobbes. The criminal justice system was underfunded, inept, and often corrupt. In 1877, notes Courtwright, some 5,000 men were on the wanted list in Texas alone, not a very encouraging sign of efficiency in law enforcement. Self-help justice was the only way to deter horse thieves, cattle rustlers, highwaymen, and other brigands. The guarantor of its deterrent threat was a reputation for resolve that had to be defended at all costs, epitomized by the epitaph on a Colorado grave marker, "He called Bill Smith a liar." One eyewitness described the casus belli of a fight that broke out during a card game in the caboose of a cattle train. One man remarked, "I don't like to play cards with a dirty deck." A cowboy from a rival company thought he said, "dirty neck." And when the gun smoke cleared, one man was dead and three wounded. It wasn't just cowboy country that developed in Hobbesian anarchy. So did parts of the West settled by miners, railroad workers, loggers, and itinerant laborers. Here is an assertion of property rights found attached to a post during the California Gold Rush of 1849. "All and everybody, this is my claim. 50 feet on the gulch, cordoned to Clear Creek District law, backed up by shotgun amendments. Any person found trespassing on this claim will be persecuted to the full extent of the law. This is no monkey tail, but I will assert my rights at the pint of the sixth shirter, if legally necessary, so take head and good warning." Courtright cites an average annual homicide rate at the time of 83 per 100,000 and points to an abundance of other evidence that Gold Rush, California was a brutal and unforgiving place. Camp names were mimetic: Gouge Eye, Murderer's Bar, Cutthroat Gulch, Graveyard Flat. There was a Hang Town, a Hell Town, a Whiskey Town, and a Gomorrah, though, interestingly, no Sodom. Mining boom towns elsewhere in the United States had annual homicide rates in the upper gallery: 87 per 100,000 in Aurora, Nevada, 105 in Leadville, Colorado, 116 in Bodie, California, and a whopping 24,000, almost one in four, in Benton, Wyoming. The trajectory of violence for California shows a rise around the 1849 gold rush, but then, together with that of the southwestern states, it shows the signature of the civilizing process: a greater than tenfold decline in homicide rates from the range of 100 to 200 per 100,000 people to the range of 5 to 15, though, as in the South, the rates did not continue to fall into the ones and twos of Europe and New England. I've included the decline for the California ranching counties, like those studied by Ellickson, to show how their current norm-governed coexistence came only after a long period of lawless violence. So at least five of the major regions of the United States — the Northeast, the Middle Atlantic states, the coastal South, California, and the Southwest — underwent civilizing processes, but at different times and to different extents. The decline of violence in the American West lagged that in the East by two centuries and spanned the famous 1890 announcement of the closing of the American frontier, which symbolically marked the end of anarchy in the United States. Anarchy was not the only cause of the mayhem in the Wild West and other violent zones in expanding America, such as laborers' camps, hobo villages, and Chinatowns, as in, "Forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown." Courtright shows that the wilderness was exacerbated by a combination of demography and evolutionary psychology. These regions were peopled by young, single men who had fled impoverished farms and urban ghettos to seek their fortune in the harsh frontier. The one great universal in the study of violence is that most of it is committed by 15 to 30-year-old men. Not only are males the more competitive sex in most mammalian species, but with Homo sapiens, a man's position in the pecking order is secured by reputation, an investment with a lifelong payout that must be started early in adulthood. The violence of men, though, is modulated by a slider. They can allocate their energy along a continuum from competing with other men for access to women, to wooing the women themselves and investing in their children, a continuum that biologists sometimes call cads versus dads. In a social ecosystem populated mainly by men, the optimal allocation for an individual man is at the cad end, because attaining alpha status is necessary to beat away the competition and a prerequisite to getting within wooing distance of the scarce women. Also favoring cads is a milieu in which women are more plentiful, but some of the men can monopolize them. In these settings, it can pay to gamble with one's life because, as Daly and Wilson have noted, any creature that is recognizably on track toward complete reproductive failure must somehow expend effort, often at risk of death, to try to improve its present life trajectory. The ecosystem that selects for the dad setting is one with an equal number of men and women, and monogamous matchups between them. In those circumstances, violent competition offers the men no reproductive advantages, but it does threaten them with a big disadvantage. A man cannot support his children if he is dead. Another biological contribution to frontier violence was neurobiological rather than sociobiological, namely the ubiquity of liquor. Alcohol interferes with synaptic transmission throughout the cerebrum, especially in the prefrontal cortex, the region responsible for self-control. An inebriated brain is less inhibited sexually, verbally, and physically, giving us idioms like beer goggles, roaring drunk, and Dutch courage. Many studies have shown that people with a tendency toward violence are more likely to act on it when they are under the influence of alcohol. The West was eventually tamed not just by flinty-eyed marshals and hanging judges, but by an influx of women. The Hollywood Western's prim, pretty schoolteachers arriving in Roaring Gulch captures the historical reality. Nature abhors a lopsided sex ratio, and women in eastern cities and farms eventually flowed westward along the sexual concentration gradient. Widows, spinsters, and young single women sought their fortunes in the marriage market, encouraged by the lonely men themselves and by municipal and commercial officials who became increasingly exasperated by the degeneracy of their Western hellholes. As the women arrived, they used their bargaining position to transform the West into an environment better suited to their interests. They insisted that the men abandon their brawling and boozing for marriage and family life, encouraged the building of schools and churches, and shut down saloons, brothels, gambling dens, and other rivals for the men's attention. Churches, with their co-ed membership, Sunday morning discipline, and glorification of norms on temperance, added institutional muscle to the women's civilizing offensive. Today we guffaw at the Women's Christian Temperance Union, with its axe-wielding tavern terrorist Carrie Nation, and at the Salvation Army, whose anthem, according to the satire, includes the lines, "We never eat cookies 'cause cookies have yeast, and one little bite turns a man to a beast." But the early feminists of the temperance movement were responding to the very real catastrophe of alcohol-fueled bloodbaths in male-dominated enclaves. The idea that young men are civilized by women and marriage may seem as corny as Kansas in August, but it has become a commonplace of modern criminology. A famous study that tracked 1,000 low-income Boston teenagers for 45 years discovered that two factors predicted whether a delinquent would go on to avoid a life of crime: getting a stable job and marrying a woman he cared about and supporting her and her children. The effect of marriage was substantial. 3/4 of the bachelors, but only 1/3 of the husbands, went on to commit more crimes. This difference alone cannot tell us whether marriage keeps men away from crime or career criminals are less likely to get married, but the sociologists Robert Sampson, John Laub, and Christopher Weimer have shown that marriage really does seem to be a pacifying cause. When they held constant all the factors that typically push men into marriage, they found that actually getting married made a man less likely to commit crimes immediately thereafter. The causal pathway has been pithily explained by Johnny Cash: "Because you're mine, I walk the line." An appreciation of the civilizing process in the American West and rural South helps to make sense of the American political landscape today. Many northern and coastal intellectuals are puzzled by the culture of their red state compatriots, with their embrace of guns, capital punishment, small government, evangelical Christianity, family values, and sexual propriety. Their opposite numbers are just as baffled by the blue staters' timidity toward criminals and foreign enemies, their trust in government, their intellectualized secularism, and their tolerance of licentiousness. This so-called culture war, I suspect, is the product of a history in which white America took two different paths to civilization. The North is an extension of Europe and continued the court and commerce-driven civilizing process that had been gathering momentum since the Middle Ages. The South and West preserved the culture of honor that sprang up in the anarchic parts of the growing country, balanced by their own civilizing forces of churches, families, and temperance. Decivilization in the 1960s. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? In? John Lennon, Revolution 1. For all the lags and mismatches between the historical trajectories of the United States and Europe, they did undergo one trend in synchrony. Their rates of violence did a U-turn in the 1960s. European countries underwent a bounce in homicide rates that brought them back to levels they had said goodbye to a century before. And in the 1960s, the homicide rate in America went through the roof. After a three-decade freefall that spanned the Great Depression, World War II, and the Cold War, Americans multiplied their homicide rate by more than 2.5, from a low of 4.0 in 1957 to a high of 10.2 in 1980. The upsurge included every other category of major crime as well, including rape, assault, robbery, and theft, and lasted, with ups and downs, for three decades. The cities got particularly dangerous, especially New York, which became a symbol of the new criminality. Though the surge in violence affected all the races and both genders, it was most dramatic among black men, whose annual homicide rate had shot up by the mid-1980s to 72 per 100,000. The flood of violence from the 1960s through the 1980s reshaped American culture, the political scene, and everyday life. Mugger jokes became a staple of comedians, with mentions of Central Park getting an instant laugh as a well-known death trap. New Yorkers imprisoned themselves in their apartments with batteries of latches and deadbolts, including the popular police lock, a steel bar with one end anchored in the floor and the other propped up against the door. The section of downtown Boston, not far from where I now live, was called the Combat Zone because of its endemic muggings and stabbings. Urbanites quit other American cities in droves, leaving burned-out cores surrounded by rings of suburbs, exurbs, and gated communities. Books, movies, and television series used intractable urban violence as their backdrop, including Little Murders, Taxi Driver, The Warriors, Escape from New York, Fort Apache, The Bronx, Hill Street Blues, and Bonfire of the Vanities. Women enrolled in self-defense courses to learn how to walk with a defiant gait, to use their keys, pencils, and spike heels as weapons, and to execute karate chops or jujitsu throws to overpower an attacker, role played by a volunteer in a Michelin Man tire suit. Red Beret Guardian Angels patrolled the parks and the transit system, and in 1984, Bernard Goetz, a mild-mannered engineer, became a folk hero for shooting four young muggers in a New York subway car. A fear of crime helped elect decades of conservative politicians, including Richard Nixon in 1968, with his Law and Order platform, overshadowing the Vietnam War as a campaign issue. George H.W. Bush in 1988, with his insinuation that Michael Dukakis, as governor of Massachusetts, had approved a prison furlough program that had released a rapist, and many senators and congressmen who promised to get tough on crime. Though the popular reaction was overblown, far more people are killed every year in car accidents than in homicides, especially among those who don't get into arguments with young men in bars, the sense that violent crime had multiplied was not a figment of their imaginations. The rebounding of violence in the 1960s defied every expectation. The decade was a time of unprecedented economic growth, nearly full employment, levels of economic equality for which people today are nostalgic, historic racial progress, and the blossoming of government social programs, not to mention medical advances that made victims more likely to survive being shot or knifed. Social theorists in 1962 would have happily bet that these fortunate conditions would lead to a continuing era of low crime, and they would have lost their shirts. Why did the Western world embark on a three-decade binge of crime from which it has never fully recovered? This is one of several local reversals of the long-term decline of violence that I will examine in this book. If the analysis is on the right track, then the historical changes I have been invoking to explain the decline should have gone into reverse at the time of the surges. An obvious place to look is demographics. The 1940s and 1950s, when crime rates hugged the floor, were the great age of marriage. Americans got married in numbers not seen before or since, which removed men from the streets and planted them in suburbs. One consequence was a bust in violence, but the other was a boom in babies. The first baby boomers, born in 1946, entered their crime-prone years in 1961. The ones born in the peak year, 1954, entered in 1969. A natural conclusion is that the crime boom was an echo of the baby boom. Unfortunately, the numbers don't add up. If it were just a matter of there being more teenagers and 20-somethings who were committing crimes at their usual rates, the increase in crime from 1960 to 1970 would have been 13%, not 135%. Young men weren't simply more numerous than their predecessors, they were more violent, too. Many criminologists have concluded that the 1960s crime surge cannot be explained by the usual socioeconomic variables, but was caused in large part by a change in cultural norms. Of course, to escape the logical circle in which people are said to be violent because they live in a violent culture, it's necessary to identify an exogenous cause for the cultural change. The political scientist James Q. Wilson has argued that demographics were an important trigger after all, not because of the absolute numbers of young people, but because of their relative numbers. He makes the point by commenting on a quotation from the demographer Norman Ryder. "There is a perennial invasion of barbarians who must somehow be civilized and turned into contributors to fulfillment of the various functions requisite to societal revival. That invasion is the coming of age of a new generation of young people. Every society copes with this enormous socialization process more or less successfully, but occasionally that process is literally swamped by a quantitative discontinuity in the number of persons involved. In 1950, and still in 1960, the invading army, those aged 14 to 24, were outnumbered 3 to 1 by the size of the defending army, those aged 25 to 64. By 1970, the ranks of the former had grown so fast that they were only outnumbered 2 to 1 by the latter, a state of affairs that had not existed since 1910. Subsequent analyses showed that this explanation is not, by itself, satisfactory. Age cohorts that are larger than their predecessors do not, in general, commit more crimes. But I think Wilson was on to something when he linked the 1960s crime boom to a kind of intergenerational decivilizing process. In many ways, the new generation tried to push back against the 8th-century movement described by Norbert Elias. The baby boomers were unusual. I know, we baby boomers are always saying we're unusual, in sharing an emboldening sense of solidarity, as if their generation were an ethnic group or a nation. A decade later, it was pretentiously referred to as Woodstock Nation. Not only did they outnumber the older generation, but thanks to new electronic media, they felt the strength of their numbers. The baby boomers were the first generation to grow up with television. And television, especially in the three-network era, allowed them to know that other baby boomers were sharing their experiences, and to know that the others knew that they knew. This common knowledge, as economists and logicians call it, gave rise to a horizontal web of solidarity that cut across the vertical ties to parents and authorities that had formerly isolated young people from one another and forced them to kowtow to their elders. Much like a disaffected population that feels its strength only when it assembles at a rally, baby boomers saw other young people like themselves in the audience of the Ed Sullivan Show, grooving on the Rolling Stones, and knew that every other young person in America was grooving at the same time, and knew that the others knew that they knew. The baby boomers were bonded by another new technology of solidarity, first marketed by an obscure Japanese company called Sony, the transistor radio. The parents of today, who complain about the iPods and cell phones that are soldered into the ears of teenagers, forget that their own parents made the same complaint about them and their transistor radios. I can still remember the thrill of tuning into signals from New York radio stations bouncing off the late-night ionosphere into my bedroom in Montreal, listening to Motown and Dylan and the British Invasion and psychedelia, and feeling that something was happening here, but Mr. Jones didn't know what it was. A sense of solidarity among 15 to 30-year-olds would be a menace to a civilized society, even in the best of times. But this decivilizing process was magnified by a trend that had been gathering momentum throughout the 20th century. The sociologist Cass Wouters, a translator and intellectual heir of Elias, has argued that after the European civilizing process had run its course, it was superseded by an informalizing process. The civilizing process had been a flow of norms and manners from the upper classes downward. But as Western countries became more democratic, the upper classes became increasingly discredited as moral paragons, and hierarchies of taste and manners were leveled. The informalization affected the way people dressed as they abandoned hats, gloves, ties, and dresses for casual sportswear. It affected the language as people started to address their friends with first names instead of Mr. and Mrs. and Miss. And it could be seen in countless other ways in which speech and demeanor became less mannered and more spontaneous. The stuffy high society lady, like the Margaret Dumont character in the Marx Brothers movies, became a target of ridicule rather than emulation. After having been steadily beaten down by the informalizing process, the elites then suffered a second hit to their legitimacy. The civil rights movement had exposed a moral blot on the American establishment, and as critics shone a light on other parts of society, more stains came into view. Among them were the threat of a nuclear holocaust, the pervasiveness of poverty, the mistreatment of Native Americans, the many illiberal military interventions, particularly the Vietnam War, and later the despoliation of the environment and the oppression of women and homosexuals. The stated enemy of the Western establishment, Marxism, gained prestige as it made inroads in Third World liberation movements, and it was increasingly embraced by bohemians and fashionable intellectuals. Surveys of popular opinion from the 1960s through the 1990s showed a plummeting of trust in every social institution. The leveling of hierarchies and the harsh scrutiny of the power structure were unstoppable, and in many ways desirable. But one of the side effects was to undermine the prestige of aristocratic and bourgeois lifestyles that had, over the course of several centuries, become less violent than those of the working class and underclass. Instead of values trickling down from the court, they bubbled up from the street, a process that was later called proletarianization and defining deviancy down. These currents pushed against the civilizing tide in ways that were celebrated in the era's popular culture. The backsliding, to be sure, did not originate in the two prime movers of Elias's civilizing process. Government control did not retreat into anarchy, as it had in the American West and in newly independent Third World countries, nor did an economy based on commerce and specialization give way to feudalism and barter. But the next step in Elias's sequence, the psychological change toward greater self-control and interdependence, came under steady assault in the counterculture of the generation that came of age in the 1960s. A prime target was the inner governor of civilized behavior, self-control. Spontaneity, self-expression, and a defiance of inhibitions became cardinal virtues. "If it feels good, do it," commanded a popular lapel button. "Do it" was the title of a book by the political agitator Jerry Rubin. "Do it till you're satisfied, whatever it is," was the refrain of a popular song by BT Express. The body was elevated over the mind. Keith Richards boasted, "Rock and roll is music from the neck downwards." And adolescence was elevated over adulthood. "Don't trust anyone over 30, advised the agitator Abby Hoffman. "Hope I die before I get old," sang The Who in My Generation. Sanity was denigrated, and psychosis romanticized in movies such as A Fine Madness, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, King of Hearts, and Outrageous. And then, of course, there were the drugs. Another target of the counterculture was the ideal that individuals should be embedded in webs of dependency that obligate them to other people in stable economies and organizations. If you wanted an image that contradicted this ideal as starkly as possible, it might be a Rolling Stone. Originally from a song by Muddy Waters, the image resonated with the times so well that it lent itself to three icons of the culture: the rock group, the magazine, and the famous song by Bob Dylan, in which he taunts an upper-class woman who has become homeless. "Tune in, turn on, drop out," the motto of one-time Harvard psychology instructor Timothy Leary, became a watchword of the psychedelia movement. The idea of coordinating one's interests with others in a job was treated as selling out. As Dylan put it, "Well, I try my best to be just like I am, but everybody wants you to be just like them. They say sing while you slave, and I just get bored. I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more." Elias had written that the demands of self-control and the embedding of the self into webs of interdependence were historically reflected in the development of timekeeping devices and a consciousness of time. This is why tendencies in the individual so often rebel against social time as represented by his or her superego, and why so many people come into conflict with themselves when they wish to be punctual. In the opening scene of the 1969 movie Easy Rider, Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda conspicuously toss their wristwatches into the dirt before setting off on their motorcycles to find America. That same year, the first album by the band Chicago, when they were known as the Chicago Transit Authority, contained the lyrics, "Does anybody really know what time it is? Does anybody really care? If so, I can't imagine why." All this made sense to me when I was 16, and so I discarded my own Timex. When my mother saw my naked wrist, she was incredulous. "How can you be a mensch without a Zager?" She ran to a drawer and pulled out a Seiko she had bought during a visit to the 1970 World's Fair in Osaka. I have it to this day. Together with self-control and societal connectedness, a third ideal came under attack: marriage and family life, which had done so much to domesticate male violence in the preceding decades. The idea that a man and a woman should devote their energies to a monogamous relationship in which they raise their children in a safe environment became a target of howling ridicule. That life was now the soulless, conformist, consumerist, materialist, ticky-tacky, plastic, white bread, Aussie and Harriet suburban wasteland. I don't remember anyone in the 1960s blowing his nose into a tablecloth, but popular culture did celebrate the flouting of standards of cleanliness, propriety, and sexual continence. The hippies were popularly perceived as unwashed and malodorous, which in my experience was a calumny. But there's no disputing that they rejected conventional standards of grooming, and an enduring image from Woodstock was of naked concertgoers frolicking in the mud. One could trace the reversal of conventions of propriety on album covers alone. There was The Who Sell Out, with a sauce-dribbling Roger Daltrey immersed in a bath of baked beans. The Beatles' Yesterday and Today, with the lovable mop tops adorned with chunks of raw meat and decapitated dolls, quickly recalled. The Rolling Stones' Beggar's Banquet, with a photo of a filthy public toilet, originally censored. And Who's Next, in which the four musicians are shown zipping up their flies while walking away from a urine-spattered wall. The flouting of propriety extended to famous live performances, as when Jimi Hendrix pretended to copulate with his amplifier at the Monterey Pop Festival. Throwing away your wristwatch or bathing in baked beans is, of course, a far cry from committing actual violence. The 1960s were supposed to be the era of peace and love, and so they were in some respects. But the glorification of dissoluteness shaded into an indulgence of violence and then into violence itself. At the end of every concert, The Who famously smashed their instruments to smithereens, which could be dismissed as harmless theater were it not for the fact that drummer Keith Moon also destroyed dozens of hotel rooms, partially deafened Peter Townsend by detonating his drums on stage, beat up his wife, girlfriend, and daughter, threatened to injure the hands of a keyboardist of the Faces for dating his ex-wife, and accidentally killed his bodyguard by running over him with his car before dying himself in 1968 of the customary drug overdose. Personal violence was sometimes celebrated in song, as if it were just another form of anti-establishment protest. In 1964, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas sang, "Summer's here and the time is right for dancing in the street." 4 years later, the Rolling Stones replied that the time was right for fighting in the street. As part of their satanic majesty and sympathy for the devil, the Stones had a theatrical 10-minute song, Midnight Rambler, which acted out a rape murder by the Boston Strangler, ending with the lines, "I'm gonna smash down on your plate glass window, put a fist through your steel-plated door. I'll stick my knife right down your throat." The affectation of rock musicians to treat every thug and serial killer as a dashing rebel or outlaw was satirized in This Is Spinal Tap, when the band speaks of their plans to write a rock musical based on the life of Jack the Ripper. Chorus, "You're a naughty one, saucy Jack." Less than 4 months after Woodstock, the Rolling Stones held a free concert at the Altamont Speedway in California, for which the organizers had hired the Hell's Angels, romanticized at the time as outlaw brothers of the counterculture, to provide security. The atmosphere at the concert, and perhaps the 1960s, is captured in this description from Wikipedia. A huge circus performer weighing over 350 pounds and hallucinating on LSD stripped naked and ran berserk through the crowd toward the stage, knocking guests in all directions, prompting a group of angels to leap from the stage and club him unconscious. Citation needed. No citation is needed for what happened next, since it was captured in the documentary Gimme Shelter. A Hell's Angel beat up the guitarist of Jefferson Airplane on stage. Mick Jagger ineffectually tried to calm the increasingly obstreperous mob, and a young man in the audience, apparently after pulling a gun, was stabbed to death by another angel. When rock music burst onto the scene in the 1950s, politicians and clergymen vilified it for corrupting morals and encouraging lawlessness. An amusing video reel of fulminating fogies can be seen in Cleveland's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum. Do we now have to, gulp, admit they were right? Can we connect the values of 1960s popular culture to the actual rise in violent crimes that accompanied them? Not directly, of course. Correlation is not causation. And a third factor, the pushback against the values of the civilizing process, presumably caused both the changes in popular culture and the increase in violent behavior. Also, the overwhelming majority of baby boomers committed no violence whatsoever. Still, attitudes in popular culture surely reinforce each other, and at the margins, where susceptible individuals and subcultures can be buffeted one way or another, there are plausible causal arrows from the decivilizing mindset to the facilitation of actual violence. One of them was a self-handicapping of the criminal justice leviathan. Though rock musicians seldom influence public policy directly, writers and intellectuals do. And they got caught up in the zeitgeist and began to rationalize the new licentiousness. Marxism made violent class conflict seem like a route to a better world. Influential thinkers like Herbert Marcuse and Paul Goodman tried to merge Marxism or anarchism with a new interpretation of Freud that connected sexual and emotional repression to political repression and championed a release from inhibitions as part of the revolutionary struggle. Troublemakers were increasingly seen as rebels and nonconformists, or as victims of racism, poverty, and bad parenting. Graffiti vandals were now artists, thieves were class warriors, and neighborhood hooligans were community leaders. Many smart people, intoxicated by radical chic, did incredibly stupid things. Graduates of elite universities built bombs to be set off at army social functions, or drove getaway cars while radicals shot guards during armed robberies. New York intellectuals were conned by Marxobabble spouting psychopaths into lobbying for their release from prison. In the interval between the onset of the sexual revolution of the early 1960s and the rise of feminism in the 1970s, the control of women's sexuality was seen as a perquisite of sophisticated men. Boasts of sexual coercion and jealous violence appeared in popular novels and films and in the lyrics of rock songs such as the Beatles' Run for Your Life, Neil Young's Down by the River, Jimi Hendrix's Hey Joe, and Ronnie Hawkins's Who Do You Love? It was even rationalized in revolutionary, political writings such as Eldridge Cleaver's best-selling 1968 memoir, Soul on Ice, in which the Black Panther leader wrote, "Rape was an insurrectionary act. It delighted me that I was defying and trampling upon the white man's law, upon his system of values, and that I was defiling his women. And this point, I believe, was the most satisfying to me, because I was very resentful over the historical fact of how the white man has used the black woman. I felt I was getting revenge." Somehow, the interests of the women who were defiled in this insurrectionary act never figured into his political principles, nor into the critical reaction to the book, New York Times, brilliant and revealing, The Nation, a remarkable book, beautifully written, Atlantic Monthly, an intelligent and turbulent and passionate and eloquent man. As the rationalizations for criminality caught the attention of judges and legislators, they became increasingly reluctant to put miscreants behind bars. Though the civil liberties reform of the era did not lead to nearly as many vicious criminals going free on a technicality, as the Dirty Harry movies would suggest, law enforcement was indeed retreating as the crime rate was advancing. In the United States from 1962 to 1979, the likelihood that a crime would lead to an arrest dropped from 0.32 to 0.18. The likelihood that an arrest would lead to imprisonment dropped from 0.32 to 0.14. And the likelihood that a crime would lead to imprisonment fell from 0.10 to 0.02, a factor of 5. Even more calamitous than the return of hoodlums to the street was the mutual disengagement between law enforcement and communities, and the resulting deterioration of neighborhood life. Offenses against civil order like vagrancy, loitering, and panhandling were decriminalized, and minor crimes like vandalism, graffiti spraying, turnstile jumping, and urinating in public fell off the police radar screens. Thanks to intermittently effective antipsychotic drugs and a change in attitudes toward deviance, the wards of mental hospitals were emptied, which multiplied the ranks of the homeless. Shopkeepers and citizens with a stake in the neighborhood, who otherwise would have kept an eye out for local misbehavior, eventually surrendered to the vandals, panhandlers, and muggers, and retreated to the suburbs. The 1960s decivilizing process affected the choices of individuals as well as policymakers. Many young men decided that they ain't going to work on Maggie's farm no more, and, instead of pursuing a respectable family life, hung out in all-male packs that spawned the familiar cycle of competition for dominance, insult or minor aggression, and violent retaliation. The sexual revolution, which provided men with plentiful sexual opportunities without the responsibilities of marriage, added to this dubious freedom. Some men tried to get a piece of the lucrative trade in contraband drugs, in which self-help justice is the only way to enforce property rights. The cutthroat market in crack cocaine in the late 1980s had a particularly low barrier for entry because doses of the drug could be sold in small amounts, and the resulting infusion of teenage crack dealers probably contributed to the 25